Welcome to the EcoCiv podcast. This is Austin Roberts. At EcoCiv, we are collaborating with others from around the world who are working toward an ecological civilization. And on this podcast, we engage leading thinkers in conversations about the kinds of transformations required to create a more sustainable, peaceful, and equitable world. You can check out our website at ecociv.org for more information. And if you enjoy this podcast, you can help support the work that we are doing at EcoCiv by making a donation at our website. For this week's episode, EcoCiv's president, Philip Clayton, talks with James Thornton, who's an environmental lawyer and founding CEO of Client Earth, Europe's first public interest environmental law organization. A member of the bars of New York, California, and the Supreme Court of the U.S., James moved from a Wall Street law practice to found the Citizens Enforcement Project at the National Resources Defense Council in New York, where he brought some 80 federal lawsuits against corporations to enforce the Clean Water Act after the Reagan administration had stopped enforcing the law. He won these cases and embarrassed the government to start enforcing the law again. James then founded Client Earth in 2007, which now operates globally and uses advocacy, litigation, and research built on solid law and science to address the greatest challenges of our time, including biodiversity loss, climate change, and toxic chemicals. Philip talks with James about the important environmental work that he is currently involved in and his own understanding of ecological civilization. And now, Philip and James.
James Thornton, thank you for joining us today on the EcoCiv podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
Normally, we move slowly from an individual's work up to the broader questions. With an organization called Toward Ecological Civilization, one understands why that might seem rather broad. For you, however, almost uniquely among the people we've talked with, to move from the question of ecological civilization to your particular work with Client Earth and in the rest of your career and back up seems like a natural circuit. So let me just start completely openly to say, what is this notion of ecological civilization? Where did you learn it? And how does it affect you in your work?
Well, so the notion of ecological civilization used in those exact terms is something I actually learned from the senior Chinese officials that I've been working with for the last 3 years. And in my meetings with them, which has been about helping the Chinese legal system cope with environmental problems and clean up the environment, we got through to the deeper questions of why and along what time frame they wanted to do this. And they quickly started saying that we have the idea of being here 2,000 years from now, as we were here 2,000 years ago. And we're very aware that we'll only be able to do that if we create an ecological civilization. And I said very politely, well, I'm aware that communism has as one of its many strengths the ability to create good slogans. Is this a slogan, or is it does it have a much deeper bottom than that? And what then ensued was a marvelous discussion in which they said, no, here are the 8 components of ecological civilization, starting with, for example, new agricultural policy for ecological civilization, new industrial policy, new energy policy, new economics, and in my case, new view of the legal system. Would you like to join a panel that is going to be reporting to the premier on how to improve the rule of law to deliver ecological civilization? And I said, well, who would not be honored to do this? And that then became a fascinating year and a half process with senior Chinese officials, senior Western people like myself. And what I saw was that this idea of ecological civilization as articulated by our Chinese colleagues is very much like something that I've been trying to talk to people about in the West for a couple of decades. You know, what I've been saying is that environmentalists like myself have been very good at articulating what the problems are. And that's understandable because the problems are relatively new. But what we haven't yet done is articulate a positive vision that can draw people into the future, and that a solely negative vision turns people off, and a positive vision is what's needed to bring people together and give them the hope they need to make the changes we need.
James, can I ask you a concrete question there? It's clear that a broad notion of ecological civilization, the movement toward a sustainable civilization, is positive. Does it do any more concrete work? I mean, you have legal specialization, you understand policy development of nations, you understand the global position. If somebody said, wait a minute, I'm glad you have a notion that makes you optimistic, but how does it help us as global activists or policy experts actually do our work better?
Well, I think in a couple of ways. One is that by having this holistic vision of an ecological civilization, you are able to see quite clearly all of the areas in which activism is required. So we're quite aware of activism being required in specific arenas. For example, the Bonn meeting, the COP is happening in Bonn right now. So on climate change, we're very aware of types of activism that need to happen. But are we as aware that activism is just as needed in economics and in industrial policy, in agricultural policy, and so on? I think maybe not. But even if we are, and even if there are some, as there are, people working in each of these areas, do we have the sense that we all need to work together and join up in order to achieve ecological civilization? And I've been having a board meeting in London for Client Earth, my organization, just a few days ago. And one of the main subjects of discussion was, we're not joined up with people working for women's rights and for all of the other things that actually need to be part of an ecological civilization, because it's not only climate policy that will get us there. It's many other things. And that sense of community working across all of these different media, I think, is one of the things that you get from ecological civilization. And it gives you hope. And listen, I mean, let's not downsell hope.
Not at all. So we see the hope function. We see the way that it moves us to a more comprehensive picture, that we don't just focus in on one or another issue, say parts per million of greenhouse gases, but we see the interconnection of issues, as in your example of women's rights and positions. Let me ask you one last question on this topic, and perhaps even more difficult. Can it help in a particular sector where the problems are so specific and, yeah, global? So let's just take an example you mentioned, agriculture. Is there some way that and this is an important one in Chinese context, some way that focusing on that long-term outcome helps us with agriculture reform now?
Well, I'm sure it does. And I mean, I can try and come up with an example for you there, but I can actually give you one from the legal arena, because I was working on that with the Chinese. So, I mean, imagining in the agricultural context, I mean, we look at the issue in China a lot of soil pollution, much worse in China than in any Western country that I've ever worked in, and the poisoning of food as a result. And what they're saying is we need this, we need to think about not just short-term ways of cleaning up the soil that we're growing crops in now, but in the much longer term of creating a way to have fertile soil and good crops that allow us to not have this problem emerge again over the next 2,000 years. So it's a very long-term view, which brings you out of the short-term problem focus into a way of saying, how do we build sustainability in so that we don't inadvertently get to the next set of problems? So I think it does that. In the legal arena where we were just working, what was interesting is you look at you tend to look at things in areas of specialty, you know, across any dimension. But in law, you'll say, well, okay, now let's work on cleaning up soil. Now let's work on reducing the amount of carbon in emissions and so on. But what we began to look at was systemically across the legal system, we may improve this or this or this, but unless at the same time the legal system is more transparent, gives more rights to participate for the people, and there are more rights of access to justice, so that when the rights guaranteed by particular laws to clean air and so on aren't given, they can go to court or some tribunal and ask for justice, unless those larger things, which aren't environmental per se, are also guaranteed, then the environmental improvements aren't going to give you ecological civilization, because the whole system has to be open, transparent, and participatory, and give people rights. And what was exciting to see about that in that discussion was we immediately got from cleaning up the environment to the empowerment of people.
Yeah. The parallels with your work and what we're doing are remarkable. I think that's why we're doing this brief interview. We're setting up 200 workshops at the World Parliament of Religions on justice as an organization called Ecological Civilization. So that connection between the justice in the broadest sense and an ecological civilization in the broadest sense, it seems deeper, tighter than most people would realize, no?
Yeah, it's absolute. Justice, you're not going to get an ecological civilization without increasing justice. And that's economic justice, it's justice across genders, and it's environmental justice, at least those three. If we were to press it, I'm sure there are more arenas.
Mm-hmm. As we were writing this book, What is Ecological Civilization? People are asking, what are the synonyms? If I can't get that word, are there any other words that are being used in other contexts that might help a listener get a fuller sense of what this admittedly somewhat abstract concept means? Do you know any synonyms? Do you use any in your work? Have you found parallels to the Chinese concept in other contexts?
Well, the best word I came up with, I hadn't broken through to that formulation until I heard it from the Chinese. But what I had been using in a more colloquial sort of term was a positive future. So if you imagine what a positive future looks like, this then is a more, in a way, technocratic way to break that down.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a positive future? A positive future is the future in which your grandchildren thrive, and the ecosystems on which they depend and are intimately interconnected with also thrive. It's really very, very simple.
Mm-hmm. David Corton has an important book, Change the Story, Change the Future, and positive future seems to have that goal. Is there a way that we can or should tell our story today, either as global citizens or members of a particular country, UK or Denmark or Nigeria? The story.
Well, I think, yes, the story question is incredibly important. And I think that is up to the people in Denmark, Nigeria, and everywhere else, because the human story takes place only in local situations. And there's a positive story to be told everywhere, and I work with Client Earthworks in 5 African countries, and it has been enormously eye-opening to work. And there, a lot of the work we do is to empower forest-dependent communities. And it's been enormously empowering to learn from the people. In this case, it's Ghana, Gabon, Republic of Congo, Liberia, and Cote d'Ivoire, about their vision, their experience, what they're looking for, what justice looks like in terms of taking care of the forests that they have traditionally and still depend on. An experience in telling story that I've had recently, which has been very encouraging, was that my partner and I, my husband and I, wrote a book called Client Earth. It's not just about the organization Client Earth, but it's about taking the earth as your client, which is the whole idea of Client Earth. We're a public interest law firm, and we take the earth as our client and everybody who lives upon her. And so we wrote the story of not just me, but many people using law in the public interest, starting in America, also in Europe, in Africa, and in China. And then we've gone around the world in our book tour and talked to people about this story of using law to protect people and the planet. And it's been a marvelous experience, because the halls have been full. I mean, an amazing one was we were invited to Australia, and the Sydney Opera House Theatre was full. It was packed. you think, wow, how lucky are we to be talking to people in this way? And then you tell stories about, you know, it's been possible. People have used law in this way to help people in this way. And at the end of it, every single time, what people have said from hearing the stories and from reading the book is, you've given me hope. I had no hope, and you've given me hope. And my life is different now. Now I'm going to find my own way to protect the environment and work in my community. And you think, well, you know, life is good. This is, you know, if you can share this hope. And it's just by telling a story, you know, and that's where the hope comes from.
We have also found the same thing. Isn't it remarkable that this framework of a future, which is a new civilization, would be concrete enough, exciting enough to people to bring hope? Let me ask you a concrete question. The book tour has received amazing coverage. I would guide listeners, for example, to the Guardian article in September. It was about the 9th or 7th. But people are startled that you and your firm could win so many cases in so many different countries with radically different legal systems and precedents. How is it possible that you could have success across so many different contexts? That's surely not just the story.
Well, no, it's a story. I mean, and it's a simple story. So what you do is you start with the goal, and the goal in, for example, cleaning up the air is to save people's health and reduce carbon emissions. And then because it is a very serious problem, and because the law all through Europe has given a context in which you can address this serious problem, you can frame your goal in the law. And then we find from country to country, citizens groups and lawyers who are interested in working with us and making these arguments. And we've won every one of these cases, you know. And what's really good is that I also see that these cases are taking judges. In Europe, the judges tend to be more conservative than I grew up in the U.S. And indeed, there are some conservative judges in the U.S., but there are a lot of progressive judges and who are comfortable with environmental cases. In Europe, traditionally, the legal system is rather more conservative. But by telling the very compelling story that thousands of people are dying early of air pollution in every one of these places, 400,000 across Europe, according to the EU, are dying early of air pollution. And this is in Europe. I mean, you know, come on. So the situation is rather dire, and the facts are the government's own facts. And when appropriately told as a story within the legal way of telling a story in court, the judges have all been moved to find for us and to go beyond what their normal comfort zone is. So in Germany, for example, the judges in Stuttgart, which is the home of Mercedes-Benz and Porsche, said, unless to the government, you clean up the air by a certain date in 2018 to the legal limit, I am going to issue a ban myself against diesel vehicles coming into Stuttgart. And this isn't the home of Mercedes. You know, this is a wonderful thing, because what it shows is the opening of the minds of these judges who are taking on board that this is a public health issue. And my job is to take care of people, not just make a dry legal ruling, but my job is actually to use my office in order to take care of the community. And you see that happening, and it's very exciting.
That's a remarkable tale, because most people outside of the law wouldn't realize that the same story you've been talking about is at the center of your incredible successes in the courtroom as well. Many people who tell the story of the movement toward ecological civilization and the dangers choose a bad guy. And it's often the extremely large and powerful corporations in a particular country, or the billionaires mm-hmm. of that country, or the multinational corporations and their role in global trade, especially the so-called North versus South. Do you tell the story that way? Do you doubt that account? Tell us a little bit about your response to that standard answer.
Well, I may have started off telling the story that way, but I've been practicing Buddhist practice for many years. And now the way I look at it is that the enemy isn't a person or a group of people, but are the mental poisons of ignorance and greed and anger. And we all have them. Some people manifest them more than others. But for me, using the law in the way we do is a form of education. It's a form of conversation and education. Now, with some people, the education goes quickly. They're receptive. With others, in order to get the conversation going, you have to really beat them over the head. But in either way, it's a conversation. And then it's a conversation about what's right. No,
I would like to ask you, if you had the chance to structure the next Parliament of the World's Religions, 15,000 people from around the world, motivated by the strongest grassroots force on the planet, which is religious belief and practice, and you came with your interest in the ecological civilization and in justice, how would you get that message across to people in hundreds and hundreds of workshops, plenary sessions lasting, you know, 2 or 3 hours? How would you message that one, since you're good with stories?
That's a great question, which I haven't thought about before. I mean, one of the things I have wondered about is how best to capture this the quite simple notion of we all want to live together. In a world which is a healthy world and a peaceful world and a world of justice and love. How do we capture those elements connected with nature into religions? And the problem I face when I think about it is that the religions, the major religions, all formed before we had ecological problems, and therefore there are very articulate ways of talking about dealing with one's fellow human beings, but that they haven't articulated a way of talking about taking care of the world in the same way as the Ten Commandments is full of how one takes care of one's relationships with people, but not with the earth, for example. Other religions quite similar. And it really is because the religions formed in a time before ecological problems were upon us. So how do we update the religions by thinking about humans in the context of a living world is the question. If you realize maybe a guided meditation of some type about, if you are a responsible person in any religion, you're honorable and you love your fellow human beings in some way and deal with them honorably. But in a guided meditation, you can see that even if that's your sole goal in life, it will be thoroughly undermined by an environment that's falling apart. Right now, imagine that Syria has the problems it has because it's the worst drought in 2,000 years, which is what some of the experts are saying. Well, no amount of good interhuman conduct is going to quickly take care of the problems of Syria because it's moved on too far. So even if we are good Muslims and good Christians and so on, the problem of the deterioration of the environment has become so deep that our normal frame of reference doesn't get us to a solution. So if we can imagine seeing that happen, then we maybe begin to imagine how being a good Muslim or being a good Christian necessarily implicates taking care of the rest of the world in order to take care of people.
You better watch out about talking about a guided meditation for 12,000 people because you might just get an invitation to lead one.
I might have to come if you invited me.
Are you optimistic that religions can update in this way that you've been describing?
I'm optimistic about everything I need to be optimistic about, and that's one of them. And certainly there are people within every one of the religions that I'm aware of, that I know anything about. There are people working on this, you know. And I mean, for example, it's very interesting to see in the born-again community in America that there are people who are very, very articulate about creation care. That's very encouraging to me.
Two brief questions to close. People may be listening to this talk or the hundreds of others you've given and say, I'm not in the context to bring a lawsuit against a major government. I'm a small person in a village or a small town. I'm an unimportant person in a large city. What would you have me do? I won't have your impact, but I want to have some. What would you tell me?
Well, two things, I think. One is that you can begin by taking care of your relationships immediately, because you have an enormous impact on everybody that you meet during the course of the day. And those relationships are part of the environment. So that if you're taking care of people, you're taking care of the environment. Beyond that, to become aware of all of your impacts on the environment. The degree to which you can save energy, you can recycle, all of those things. But if you have a little more money and can go beyond that, you might learn about the environment and support an environmental group, because you don't yourself have to bring lawsuits, but you can support a group that works on saving habitat or giving clean water where it's not available. And there are 1,000 environmental groups that are worth supporting, and even a little bit of support is very important.
Fantastic. And a final question, Mr. Thornton. You have said that you are optimistic about those things where you have to be optimistic. And one of those must be the transition to an ecological civilization. Could you tell us in closing, starting from today until, inshallah, we are finally reaching that place, what does the transition look like? I don't mean detail by detail, but in the biggest sense of a transition of humankind, some vision of from here to there in three great steps or however you conceive it.
Well, that's a wonderful question. And I don't think anybody knows it, but I think we already see the signs of it beginning. And I think it will surprise us. And one sign of it beginning is that the Chinese, which is something most people don't know in the West, have become so extremely concerned about cleaning up the environment. And they're going to do it no matter what. And I've heard from the senior officials, no matter what anyone else does in the world, we understand that this is in the interest of our people, so we're going to do it. So one thing is the country which is the greatest polluter and the one that many people thought was most remote from good action in this area has become perhaps already the world leader in cleaning up. So that's one thing. That's an unexpected and wonderful step. That's a breakthrough. The other breakthrough is the Paris Agreement. Now, on climate change, which was signed a couple of years ago. And here we have now every country in the world, America is still signed up, and the president can't take America out until the day after the next presidential election, which is interesting. But assuming that America leaves, it will be the only country. There were two other holdouts, Nicaragua and Syria. And we talked about Syria a minute ago. Syria is in terrible shape. But last week, Syria said, we're going to sign the Paris Agreement. Nicaragua said it a few weeks earlier. So at the moment, every country in the world is either signed up or about to sign up to make enormous transition in order to prevent climate change. And the Paris Agreement leaves it up to the country to as how to do it, which is a good idea. But it's a very serious commitment to thorough change. And that's thorough change in how we use energy. And that will get you into the other elements of ecological civilization, in that it will also change agriculture and it will also change industrial policy, for example. And then we need to make sure that it also picks up the elements of justice and social equality. But those two things, the biggest polluter in the world has decided to really shift and is shifting as quickly as it can, and that every country in the world now has signed up to the Paris Agreement. Those, I think, are two remarkable shifts, unforeseeable, really, 10 years ago. So those are two huge steps to ecological civilization, and then the next ones will surprise us.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
That's what's great, that they will be surprising.
Yeah. That's the beauty of a notion that's so broad, nobody could possibly know how we'll get there. And yet you show there is a way to see it step by step. We can't know them all. As a thing that human species can achieve.
Absolutely, yeah. And we better achieve it if we want to stay a species.
Exactly. James Thornton, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Your success on behalf of your client Earth is remarkable. I don't think anyone globally has ever had that sort of success. And the thought of that same person leading 12 to 15,000 people from around the world in a guided meditation as a Zen priest is a remarkable thought.
Thank you very much.
Best wishes and thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.